Funding for Think comes from SMU's Informal Courses for Adults.
You are listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. How fluid is your speech? Can you ramble on for minutes at a time without getting tongue-tied? Or are your sentences peppered with pauses, restarts, and slips of the tongue? While many of us are irritated by other speakers who make these mistakes, especially on the radio, the truth is just about all of us make errors in everyday speech, upwards of 20 times a day. But what do our bloopers say about who we are, what we know, and what we're thinking? Well, it may take you by surprise. Journalist and linguist Michael Erard has learned this. He's just added a new afterword to his book, Slips, Stumbles, and Verbal Blunders, and What They Mean. And the updated version is out now in paperback. He's here to talk about it. Michael, welcome back to Think.
Hey, Chris. Thanks for having me.
So what are these verbal blunders that you're examining in the book?
So verbal blunders, you know, are two things. One, slips of the tongue, the spoonerisms, malapropisms, all of these mischosen words, these kind of moments of impromptu and unexpected poetry. The other thing that I include as verbal blunders are all of the hesitations and the on-the-fly revisions, the filled pauses, the silent pauses, saying and on, repeating words, restarting sentences, things like that, all of the phenomena that make our spoken sentences very unlike our written ones.
Now, it's a relatively recent development that linguists have even deemed these things worthy of studying. Why were they dismissed before?
They were dismissed before because there was no real theory that would make them interesting. You know, they were really kind of treated as detritus, as stuff that you just ignored when you heard it. You ignored it when other people said it. When you had transcripts, you cleaned it out. And that was really the case in a lot of fields, you know, say in psychology in the 50s, when there were a lot of attempts to try to understand how patterns of speaking might reveal some underlying thought process or something. Those transcripts were typically cleaned up. Somebody that I write about in the book, George Male at Yale, was one of the first people to realize that the things that were being cleaned out of these transcripts were potentially had a lot of information in them.
It's so interesting about how what gets left on the cutting room floor ultimately is the gold.
Yeah, yeah. Well, do you have a blooper file?
Oh, Jeff keeps
one.
My producer, yeah. And in fact, when I don't think you heard it, at the beginning of the hour, I had to do a little promo. And sure enough, I had one of those slips of the tongue. I needed to say slips of the tongue, and then I needed to say the word after that. And I said slips of the tum. So what's a mistake like that?
Oh, that's a great mistake.
So, thank you. I have a gift for that.
We're going to put that in the error in the area of a slip of the tongue, right? A speech error. You didn't intend to make that, and you knew perfectly well what you were supposed to say, and you were probably reading something, and your eyes jumped ahead, or your eyes sort of jumped ahead, and that fed into what you were saying. Now, and this is something that people can use and keep in mind when they listen to people speaking in the upcoming political conventions, where, you know, the official speeches that people give will be rehearsed and scripted, and people will not be extemporizing at all. They'll be reading from teleprompters. So they will tend to make the sort of mistake that actually you just made. When people practice, they make fewer errors overall, but the errors that they do make will be that kind of anticipatory error. So when you say slip of the tongue, you were anticipating the that was going to come after tongue, right?
Mm-hmm.
And that's a sort of one of the functions of practice and rehearsal. We can't eliminate all of the errors that we make, but people who are practiced will make more of those anticipatory errors rather than an error that the technical word is a perseveratory error, one where a sound or a word hangs around so after it's been spoken. So you might have said slip of the tongue, I don't know if that's going to come across clearly enough on this connection, but where the last sound of the word tongue sort of hangs around and becomes part of your filled pause.
So you carry it forward.
You didn't say that. Yeah, it sort of carries forward.
So I was really interested to read in the book that there are two kinds of categories that people fall into. There are the people who pause a lot and say and ah, and then there are the people who forge boldly ahead but sort of correct themselves as they go if they're speaking extemporaneously.
Yeah. All of us have our own unique pattern of fluency and disfluency. But when you are able to record people and transcribe exactly what they're doing and map that out, people fall into two general groups. So one group is more apt to plan, and part of that planning means that they say more they have more silent pauses. And I, for instance, am a planner, which doesn't really work so well on the radio. That's probably why I'm a writer. The other group are repeaters, or the technical word is deleters. Those people tend to restart their sentences, and those are the people who, well, once they get going, they might decide, but that's not the exact place to start. Let's start here. They never actually finish the sentence or finish the thought because they're constantly going back and revising. Those are also the people who will typically, it's the first group. The ummers will say and they'll also repeat words so that they don't violate the rule about saying they might repeat a word like that in order to give themselves some time to think.
You said this rule about it does seem that people are really bothered by that. And I'm wondering why it seems to make us so crazy.
Yeah, I was really curious about that too. You know, that's such a deeply held idea, such that, I mean, all of us, you know, have probably taken public speaking courses in school or something and had teachers who were punishing us. I heard an incredible story about a graduate student on the first day of class who really wanted to impress the professor and was really prepared. Professor asked the question, you know, the very first question that she asked, student raises her hand, and professor calls on her, and she says, and the professor stops her and says, you are stupid, and goes on. And the student was so appalled that she said, she told me this, it took her 3 weeks to actually get up the courage to say anything else in class. That's how much of a sort of bias or whatever there is against the people who say, I went back as far as the ancient Greeks to try to see if there was any specific rule against saying or. I also visited some of the Roman writers on rhetoric and oratory, and there was no mention. They certainly had their pet peeves about what to avoid. It was Quintilian, who really hated people who sounded like they were singing when they talked. But that focus on, you know, avoiding, it doesn't emerge until the early 20th century in the U.S. What's the attitude in other countries and other languages? I don't know. But in the U.S., it wasn't until the turn of the century, right around the time that more and more people are probably hearing themselves on recordings, when the phonograph becomes a technology that more and more people are encountering and probably have in their homes. And then it really takes off with the advent of radio, where you have not only sort of the growth of, you know, questions about, well, how do we speak on the radio? Are we supposed to orate in the old style with the sort of chest-thumping, stentorian nature, or can it be something that's more quiet? And certainly electric amplification changed the way that people spoke too. I kind of think that a little of it has to do with the switch actually from non-amplified public speaking to amplified public speaking, that when people were speaking without microphones, they had to stop and take big inhalations in order to be able to project into a room. And that allowed them to figure out where they were in their speech and to think about what they were going to say. When you're speaking into a microphone, you don't have that need for that intake of breath. And as a result, you need some other way to buy yourself some time. And this is something that is entirely natural and is just a feature of the way that the brain processes language. It's very difficult for us to think novel thoughts and speak fluently at the same time. There are some people who are able to do that, and I call them sort of the supermodels of talking. And they shouldn't, you know, they're kind of they're freaks.
Genetic aberrations.
Yeah, they're aberrations. I guess that's a nicer way to say than freaks. But it's almost like it's unfair to the great majority of us to have them held up as the models that the rest of us should aspire to be. It's just going to lead to, it's just a path of towards depression.
And contrary, Michael, to what that professor said, scientists have found no relationship whatsoever between the frequency of ums and uhs and people's intelligence.
None whatsoever, yeah. So what I come down on and what I really found in my research for the book is that the hesitations are very good indicators of states of mind, emotional states, whether someone is distracted, whether someone is tired, whether someone is thinking about too many things at the same time. They're not very reliable indicators of traits, intelligence, moral character, leadership, things like that. Of course, stereotypically, we all want to understand something about the traits of a speaker. And that's why we listen to the hesitations that they use. But that, for me, starts to get very close to kinds of linguistic discrimination, you know, where you try to make broad generalizations about someone essentially or inherently based on the way that they speak, and that's pretty dangerous.
Yeah, a lot of people assume that somebody who hesitates a lot might be more inclined to prevaricate, to lie.
To lie, yeah, and that's another thing that, you know, certainly the government is, and has always been, you know, law enforcement has been interested in trying to figure out how. I mean, it would make a lot of people's jobs a lot easier if you could just hook someone up to a machine that would count their uhs and the ums or the amount of time that it takes them to respond to a question and give them, you know, some sort of truthfulness rating. But, you know, and people can do this even in their daily lives. So I said before that everyone has a certain baseline. It's not the absolute presence or absence of an or an or a pause or a repeated word or one of these other phenomena that's meaningful. What's meaningful is the deviation from the baseline. So you might get stopped by a policeman, and he'll just ask you some questions, some pretty basic questions, and that's what he's trying to do is get a sense of what your baseline is, and then he'll ask you the hard questions to give him to get you to say something that that might deviate from the answers that you previously gave and the style in which you gave them.
Michael Erard is my guest. He's a linguist and journalist. His book is called Slips, Stumbles, and Verbal Blunders and What They Mean. We'll be back to our conversation in just a moment. You are welcome to call us at 1-800-933-5372, or you can send email to think@kera.org. After the break, we'll talk about why Michael believes we may have misunderestimated the abilities of our president.
Think is made possible by SMU's informal courses for adults. The worlds of Manet, Miro, Marx, and Macbeth are yours to explore. Details online at smu.edu/think.
You're You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is linguist and journalist Michael Erard. His book is called Slips, Stumbles, and Verbal Blunders and What They Mean. It has just been updated and re-released in paperback. If you'd like to join us, you can call 1-800-933-5372 or send email to think@kera.org. Of course, before the break, I sort of teased everyone with a deliberate use of the word misunderestimated, which is one of those things that people just go crazy about because President Bush will make a verbal gaffe now
right.
and then.
Yeah, and the phones lit up with people eager to point out that you had chosen the wrong word.
Your announcer said the word misunderestimated in a show about good speech. Yeah,
there are people who actually use it intentionally now. It's one of those things that it has kind of entered the lexicon, and I wouldn't be surprised if, you know, we come to find our children and our grandchildren someday using it as a real word, and we have to say, back in my day, there was a president. Oh, never mind.
but you actually think that people are too harsh with him?
I don't. You know, I think that our fascination with Bushism said much more about the electorate and the media than it actually did about the man. I don't remember anyone noting Bush as any sort of a verbal blunderer when he was governor, and maybe that has to do with the fact that Texas governor really is not as powerful a figure as the president, so people aren't hanging on and reporting every word of the governor. So maybe that had something to do with it, but I think there was also this sort of transition from a more local stage to the national stage that meant, one, he was speaking more often, two, there was more scrutiny placed on what he said, and also there was a certain kind of media narrative that was being crafted, and I don't, you know, mean to suggest that there's like a media sort of conspiracy there, but I went looking in LexisNexis and found only very few stories about some of Bush's slips of the tongue before Dan Quayle left the race. Once Quayle left the race, that's when everyone started picking up on Bush and Bushisms and these verbal blunders. It was almost as if there was a role that was written and the actor left, and they needed to find someone else to play that role. And Bush, in a couple fairly high-profile interviews, you know, the first one that he gave in Austin, that was his foreign policy interview. He said he called the Greeks the Grecians and the Kosovars the Kosovians and things like that. That had everyone rolling around on the floor and laughing, and that was kind of the kickoff of his reputation.
And that seems to be the case also for the man who was perhaps the most famous verbal blunderer in the history of the English language, the Reverend Spooner.
Yeah. So everyone knows the Spoonerism, and it's people make them all the time. They're funny, sometimes deliberately, as in saying the gride and the broom, sometimes totally inadvertently. My wife referred to the camera battery as the Camry batterer, which is an interesting Spoonerism. Spoonerisms usually take the first parts of words and reverse them, but my wife, who's very verbally adept, switched the last parts of the words, and she loves it when I talk about her slips on the radio. Spooner, William Archibald Spooner, was this Oxford don, you know, so he was an actual guy, a very well-educated and very well-respected guy who was also fairly absent-minded and who had a reputation for saying things in which he did this with sounds or he reversed words sometimes. And at the end of his life, he was interviewed and was asked about the Spoonerism. He was known around the world for being the guy who made the mistakes, but he could only remember actually making one, and this was the one. He was in chapel and announcing the hymn, and instead of saying conquering kings their titles take, he said kinkering kongs. their titles take. And so what is, how do you explain that sort of difference between, you know, he could only remember saying one versus the hundreds that were attributed to him? And it seems as if there were a lot of very verbally creative, prankful undergraduates at Oxford who were making these things up and then attributing them to Spooner, and that's how they spread.
My favorite false one, I think, was somebody saying, "My lord is a shoving leopard," instead of "My lord is a loving shepherd." We have an email from Annette in Richardson who says, I've often wondered whether patterns of misused words identify speakers who do not read widely. One of my favorite examples is using the word antidote when the speaker actually means anecdote. Is there any evidence this is the case?
Yeah, so there's an interesting language blog that I would encourage people to go look up. It's a group of linguists who blog at languagelog.com. And what they've done is identified a group of words that they call eggcorns. And the anecdote mistake seems to fall into the eggcorn area. An eggcorn is a mischosen word. So it's a kind of malapropism, sort of like misunderestimate. And eggcorn is itself an eggcorn of acorn. It's the wrong word, right? But if you look into it, it kind of makes a little bit of sense. There's a little bit of poetry there, and you can construct a story about why that's actually the right word. So it's not entirely an error, right? You couldn't go back to those people and say, "Hey, do you know you said something wrong?" And they'd say, "Oh, yeah, gee, I don't know what happened. Just I totally had a slip there. I know what the real word is. The word is this. I apologize." And it's not purely a situation where you go and you say, "Have you never learned the right word?" They'll say, "Yeah, I've learned the right word, but this is the one, but I used this other one." So all of us have these, some of us less than others, but we all possess these areas where we haven't quite fully learned the language yet. I mean, I'll confess to one, begging a question. What does begging the question mean? It's something from philosophy, and you know, I don't expect anybody to call in with an answer. If somebody did, that would be great, actually. But antidote is another one of these corners where people haven't quite fully learned what the real form is and what it's supposed to be.
And remarkably, though, things like antidote and anecdote and eggcorn and acorn, they're the same part of speech. When we make these mistakes, we don't accidentally substitute in an adverb where a noun should be.
And that's another interesting aspect of all of the slips of the tongue, that they aren't random, you know. They have a lot of patterns in them. So back to malapropisms, for instance, most malapropisms, most mischosen words, will in fact share some features with the word that with the correct word. It very often starts with the same sound. It very often has the same number of syllables, and it very often has the same stress pattern. It can also be semantically related, the two words, which is why I think that the Osama Obama slips are almost it's pure slip. You know, the words sound so similar, and they both belong to that class of words that they're foreign names. Depending on what your politics are, they might be people that you don't necessarily like. And you might say one name more than the other. That's an example of going down a certain path and sort of choosing a word for you that and relying on other habits and reaching for another automatic pattern, right?
But sometimes a cigar is just a cigar. There's no such thing really as a Freudian slip.
The Freudian slip. You know, probably the most familiar of all of the slips of the tongue. You know, Freud was not the only person in his day who was interested in these sorts of deviations. And when it came time for him to analyze what these things meant, he chose the ones that would really support his own ideas about the nature of the self. His idea was that we had lots of conflicting impulses, and that all of those impulses we couldn't necessarily communicate. We had to repress them, and that sometimes they would pop out when we weren't expecting them. There was another guy I discovered who's a contemporary of Freud's, named Rudolf Meringer, who actually collected thousands and thousands of slips well before Freud got interested in them. And his analysis was very different. He basically had he found that when you introduced another sound or reversed sounds or introduced another word, that a lot of that was due to stuff that was to other sounds or other words that were in the same thing that you were trying to say. So back to your slip before, the slip of the tum, right? The was in what you were going to say, and that kind of snuck over into what you actually did say.
So it doesn't reveal that I wanted an acid.
Yeah, no.
Exactly.
I don't think so.
No.
I mean, and when my mother says my brother's name instead of my name, it doesn't mean that that she loves him more than she loves me.
Probably not.
No, I mean, I'm
teasing you.
He lives closer,
mm-hmm.
and she sees him more often, so she uses his name more frequently. There's also, I mean, the great slip that President Bush used, and this is a perfect distinction between, or a perfect example of the Freudian analysis of a speech error versus, you know, a more mundane example. He was on a press conference talking about, and this was several years ago, talking about elections that were about to happen in Iraq, and he said, look, this is a historic moment. Who would have expected that we would have had erections in, and he paused, and he said, elections in Iraq. Somebody could, of a Freudian bent, could say, aha, well, what that is actually a sign that, you know, there's some link between, you know, war making and sexuality, sexual performance. But a linguist would just say, look, there was an R in Iraq, there was an L in election, and phonetically they're very similar, and he just reversed them.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. We're talking to Michael Erard. His book, newly updated, is called Slips, Stumbles, and Verbal Blunders and What They Mean. Let's speak to Shannon in Dallas. Hi, Shannon.
Hi, great topic. Thank you.
Thank you.
Michael, I was watching an Oprah episode probably a couple years ago, and yep. The inimitable J-Lo, Jennifer Lopez, was on, and it was so exasperating to me, almost as bad as hearing the word was every few words she peppered in, you know, da-da-da-da, you know,
mm-hmm.
and in that Brooklyn accent of hers, too, which just made it, I hate to say, far worse for my Texas ear. And I just wanted to get your take on it when somebody is speaking quickly, and instead of the word they're inserting, you know?
So you didn't like that?
She's there. Shannon, you didn't like it, right? I guess she hung up, and as they say, taking her answer off the air. Let's assume she didn't like it.
So some people, you know, they have, you know, there I go. They have internalized that rule against saying so much that they don't say it, but what do they do when they need to buy themselves some time? So there are a number of other phrases that people begin to rely on, and you know is one of them. Well is another one that people comment on a lot. So is another one that people comment a lot. So it's interesting to listen to people who don't say for those other sorts of behaviors that buy themselves some time. Some people like to repeat words at the beginning of sentences. Some people lengthen their vowels in their words, and I know that that's something that I do myself. So I will sometimes talk like this if I'm trying to come up with what I'm going to say next.
I thought it was interesting to read that and actually have two separate functions. One's for a little pause and one's for a long pause.
Yeah, so there were two Stanford psychologists who were looking at and everyone wants to sort of figure out what these things really mean, and surely they're there for some sort of reason. And why why not just one? And why not silence is another question. But why why the difference? And they looked at some speakers who were saying both and what they found was that preceded a different sort of pause than an The both and they found were signals to listeners that I'm having some problems coming up with what I'm going to say next. That's kind of the subtext, the message of the and the And what it turns out is that the problem that the speaker has after they say the involves a smaller amount of time than when they say This is a fairly controversial proposal, and not everybody agrees with it. But it does raise to the status more of words that we choose deliberately and that have separate meanings from each other. And certainly that's a pretty radical proposal for a word that we're told not to say at all.
Well, they're handy. I'm thinking about sometimes on the radio when I have a guest on the phone, and if they don't say or and I don't get that cue, sometimes mm-hmm. I'll start to ask the next question, and in fact, they're planning to continue what they're saying.
Yeah, right. That's why sometimes, you know, in studio interviews, I mean, do you think that in studio guests, that those go better than on the phone? Because you can you have visual cues, and you can see people starting to talk and answer. And
yeah, eye contact makes a big difference, especially if it's someone who doesn't give a lot of verbal cues.
Uh-huh, right. I'll tell you about flaky in a bit.
Okay, great. Michael Erard is with us. We'll be back to our conversation in just a moment. The book is called Slips, Stumbles, and Verbal Blunders and What They Mean. If you want to join us, call 1-800-933-5372 or send email to think@kera.org.
Think is made possible by SMU's informal courses for adults. The worlds of Manet, Miro, Marx, and Macbeth are yours to explore. Details online at smu.edu/think.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd, speaking this hour with Michael Erard, the linguist and journalist. His book is called Slips, Stumbles, and Verbal Blunders and What They Mean. If you want to join us, the number is 1-800-933-5372. So tell us how Flaky the robot could teach phone guests a thing or two.
So you were talking before about people who don't say your remote guests, people you can't see, and how without feedback as to whether they're even there anymore, things might get a little roiled. So Flaky was a robot that could understand spoken commands. It was developed out in California at a research institute. And you'd say, Flaky, go get me a cup of coffee. And Flaky would sit there, and then he would go get you a cup of coffee. The problem was that maybe it was your first time interacting with Flaky, or you thought that Flaky had just gotten a software update, and so you thought that Flaky should maybe move a little faster or whatever. Flaky just sat there. You maybe think that it wasn't working well, or it wasn't working the way that it should. So you might give it another command, or you repeat the command, and that's when you really start to foul the robot up. So there was a speech researcher working at this institute at the time who suggested, why don't we make these interactions easier and program Flaky to say So when Flaky hears the command and is processing it, it says Actually, it would sort of make a weird sound, but it was Flaky's approximation of But it was the signal to the human that I heard your command and I'm processing it. Don't repeat the command. And it was really useful for getting Flaky to work the right way.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. We have an email from Victor in Fort Worth, who's originally from Mexico but has been living in the U.S. for 7 years. He says, sometimes when I'm trying to say something really fast in English or not paying too much attention, I insert words in Spanish or the Spanish equivalent of the ums and ahs into my sentences in English. Can you explain how that works or why it happens?
So one of the ways to really sound much more like a native speaker of any language is to pause the way that native speakers pause. So instead of saying the este or the e of Spanish, to say the and the um. As far as inserting other words, it depends on who Victor's talking to. Is this really a matter of an error, or is this an intentional use of Spanish with someone who he thinks might understand him, which is something called code switching, which in Texas you're going to hear a lot of people who are both speakers of both Spanish and English switching back and forth between the two languages. Not because they don't know what the equivalent words are in each, but because there's some social reason or some emotional reason for them to say it in one language or the other.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's go next to Robert in Dallas. Hello, Robert.
Hello.
Hey, Robert.
I know what begging the question means.
Oh, perfect.
And I'm not surprised that you don't know, because you hardly ever hear it used properly on television, for example, or radio. People use the phrase in an effort to seem, I guess, well-read, because they know the phrase, then they don't use it properly, which is kind of negates the impression they're trying to create.
Right. So give it to us.
It's very difficult to define generally, but the example will let you know. Begging the question is answering the question with a non-answer, such as the question is, why did you do that? And the guy answers, because I wanted to. Well, that's obvious, but it doesn't really answer the question, and begs further questioning of, well, why did you want to? And it gives another non-answer that doesn't really explain why he did that, and it just keeps begging the original question.
As opposed to making a statement and then following that with what seems like the obvious question.
Yes.
Oh, thank you very much for that.
Thanks, Robert.
Okay, anytime.
Thanks. 1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. You've learned that men stumble more than women, Michael. Why is that?
Oh, now you're really going to get me in trouble, right?
Your wife has to pay you back for all her mistakes.
There was some research where people are, looking very closely at pairs of people, men and women, doing certain tasks, and they're tape recorded to try to see who is disfluent when, who starts to hesitate and stumble when doing what task and playing what role. And what they found was that the men and the women overall were equally disfluent, but the men tended to say the or the more frequently. And that sort of goes back to what we were talking about before, as having a social function, as being actual words that people decide to use. And the idea, the reason that is often given for why men might do this more, is that also serve the place of placeholders in the conversation. So it sort of signals, I don't know exactly what my contribution to the conversation is going to be, but I'm not done. I'm not ready to give you your turn yet. I'm still going to keep my turn. So it signals, don't interrupt me.
Why is it that preschoolers and drunks don't pause as much as everybody else?
Well, the argument about drunks is that they are somehow less self-conscious when they speak. There were researchers who went out, and I don't know, I think that these guys just went out for a good time and decided to turn it into a research project while they were out. They were listening to the number of uhs and ums that people used and correlated that to the amount that they were drinking, and they found that of course, the more the people were drinking, the less they said, which might sound like a really great way to reduce your uhs and ums overall if you wanted to do that, but they figured that you'd have to drink something like 18 beers in order to become totally umless. As for the preschoolers, well, you know, before a certain age, little kids won't actually pause like adults will. It's something that they have to learn how to do. It's part of being a fluent native speaker, and you have to learn how to do it in the appropriate ways. So little kids, they'll say at the beginning of a sentence, but you can tell that kids are actually becoming more sophisticated with their language when they start putting in the middle of their sentences, or maybe even between phrases or inside phrases. That means that they understand that, you know, the dog is not one unit. There are actually two things there, the and dog.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's speak next to David in Arlington. Hello, David.
Hi. I had a question. I'm not a linguist by any stretch of the imagination, but I've always assumed that and were there, the sound was there, the schwa sound was there, because it's the most default, basic, do-nothing kind of shape inside your mouth. But then I read other foreign books, you know, books where British, where they'll say and you hear other people from other countries saying that, and I'm trying to reconcile that in my brain, why some cultures, some dialects and languages seem to have a different than mine.
That is a great question, and this is an important point. If my book changes American culture in any way, I hope this is it. So you're right, we say and because that's the easiest vowel to say. And if in other dialects people are choosing another vowel, like in French, it's e, because they have a different set of vowels, so their default vowel, their most neutral vowel, will be slightly different than the or the Now, the British ER, there is not actually a filled pause. Is everyone sitting down? There is no filled pause pronounced It's actually pronounced That's a British spelling of in the same way that they would pronounce the word butter, B-U-T-T-E-R, as butta. It's that same ER. So next time you hear someone saying ER, you can actually correct them and say that there is no such word, that people are taking the spelling and pronouncing the spelling literally, but it's a British spelling. So that's the reason why, David.
And we might as well go on the record and say that UGH is not pronounced UG, but UH.
Oh, is that true?
Yeah.
Oh, well, there you go. Two important points here. Beg the question, and the pronunciation of and UG, or sorry.
Learn something new every day.
Yep.
People who gesture more with their hands say less. Do we know why?
I don't know that we know why. It was some sort of connection. It probably has to do with, in the brain, these two functions, these two behaviors as sharing the same part of the brain, controlling them. And what they did find was that people who are allowed to gesture more when they speak are more fluent, and that when you take one of their hands and tie it down, they will become that much more disfluent, they'll become more hesitant in things, and that when you take both of their hands away, they'll become even more disfluent. So in an effort, no one can see this because this is radio, but in my effort to become as fluent as possible, I'm gesturing like mad.
It is helpful in radio. You can't do that in TV so much.
Yeah, no. And sometimes, you know, when I'm in a studio, it's a little bit of a detriment because, you know, I'm not used to it, but I'll gesture and I'll end up whacking the microphone.
Is there a sign language equivalent of these placeholders?
There is. So sign languages, you know, I mean, again, the hesitating, having to choose what you're going to say, having to plan, that's the way that the brain works, regardless of whether you're going to say words or sign words. So the ASL sign for is actually sort of take your right hand, you have your palm towards you, your thumb up, and you sort of circle your hand towards you and away at about chest level over and over. There's another way to signal kind of thinking or a pause where you would sign and then you would pause, sort of freeze your hands and twiddle all your fingers back and forth. That would tell the person that you're talking to that you're trying to think of what to say next.
If we go quickly, we have time for one more call, and that's from Bill in Fort Worth. Hi, Bill.
Hi. I had a question as far as the and the are placeholders, so to speak, for the speaker, but I've noticed it's almost more these days, it seems like, for the listener, as attention spans are getting a little shorter, it's almost saying, hey, I'm not done yet, don't drift off. So is there a correlation between shrinking attention spans and a rise in the use of and ums?
That's a really interesting question. I don't think that I've noticed a correlation there. You know, you can definitely see that a rise in and is related to just a more tolerant acceptance of more natural speech. For instance, I won't expect to hear any uhs and ums in any political convention speeches, but you can certainly hear it more often on the radio and more often on television. There's also the way in which the uhs and the ums serve as, you know, help us be more polite. So if we want to say something that is maybe a little difficult to say, we might precede it with an R and to signal that we are saying this with great thoughtfulness and a certain amount of reluctance, you know, to say, well, the ring wasn't cheap, ..
So letting people know, don't take this the wrong way, but here comes something.
Yeah, I haven't rushed into saying this.
And it's funny, we use it that way in informal written speech now.
Yeah, do a search in LexisNexis or on Google, and people use it in a lot of different ways.
Do you find people trying to count how many uhs and ums you do since the book has come out?
Well, sometimes in the middle of an interview, if I say people will say, ah, you said our But what I always say is, you know, look, I've trademarked the word, and I'm just exercising my intellectual property.
You really have trademarked it. Do you own it now?
Well, no.
If you could have a nickel for every time somebody said it.
Oh, I would be rich, yeah.
Michael Erard is a journalist and a linguist. His book is called Slips, Stumbles, and Verbal Blunders and What They Mean. Michael, it's always a pleasure. Thanks so much for joining
us. Thank you, Chris.
My name is Chris Boyd. Thank you for listening and have a great day.
Think is produced by Jeff Whittington and engineered by Jeannie Mascoro. Learn about upcoming programs, subscribe to our free daily podcast, and order CD copies of your favorite Think shows on the radio page of KERA.org. And we'd like to hear what you think about Think. Email your comments, questions, and suggestions to think@KERA.org.